Game on 2FM with Green Farm. Get real with Green Farm's chicken and turkey range. Real protein, real tasty.
Game on, weeknights from 6
on 2FM.
Johnny B, Johnny Smacks, thank you both very much for kicking off the weekend in perfect style. Yes, it's Friday the 8th of April and I'm Shane Dawson and you're listening to Game On. Coming up this evening, Aintree, Augusta and Aldi. Ruby Walsh is live from Aintree and Jane Mangan will be dialing in as well as we look forward to tomorrow's Grand National and look back on a dramatic day 2 of the festival. Greg Allen brings us the latest from the Masters in Augusta and we have tickets to Ireland v Italy in the Women's Six Nations and an Aldi voucher to give away with that as well. And to chat all things Six Nations, we will be chatting to Alison Donnelly of scrumqueens.com. And in association football, well, that will be box off with Fergal Brennan and Alan Colley as we look ahead at a big weekend in the English Premier League and, of course, in the League of Ireland with an impartial nod to the two most successful clubs in Ireland going head-to-head in the traditional Dublin derby. It is, of course, Shelburne versus Shamrock Rovers this evening at Talca Park, a North Dublin venue that ushers in the attitude of retro is beautiful. Lots to get through over the next hour. As always, if you want to get involved, you can do so by dropping us a text on 51552 or tweet at GameOn2FM.
GameOn2FM.
Yes, hello there. It is 4 minutes past 6. I hope you're getting set for an enjoyable weekend of sport wherever you are tuning in from. As always, it is great to have your company here on 2FM. Now, before we get into the nuts and bolts of this weekend's sport and today's sport, it is competition time. So, we have teamed up with Aldi, official fresh food partner to Irish rugby, to give away a pair of tickets to the TikTok Women's Six Nations match between Ireland and Italy in Musgrave Park this Sunday. A match we'll be previewing a little bit later on this evening with Alison Donnelly. One lucky person will win a pair of tickets to the game plus a €50 voucher for Aldi. So, to be in with a chance of winning, please text 51552 with your name and answer to the following question. Who is the head coach of the Irish women's rugby team? So stay tuned as the winner will be selected and contacted before 7pm this evening. As always, RTE competition terms and conditions apply. See 2fm.ie for details. So our first port of call this evening is to go live to Greg Allen, who is over at Augusta. Greg, a mixed day, I suppose, for the Irish yesterday. Sung Jae Im was the overnight leader. What has changed overnight since play began at 1 o'clock this afternoon?
The wind. Nothing else but the wind has changed. And it's, obviously a lot has changed as a result of the wind. But that's the big factor that's really sending scores, not so much spiralling, but it's sending them in the direction of anything like level par is going to be a pretty good score today. So Cameron Smith started the day one shot behind Sung Jae Im. Sung Jae Im actually played a really steady front line, but he did benefit from having the calmest conditions because it really wasn't blowing this morning. The wind has only got up in the early afternoon. But Sung Jae Im now is at in the middle of Eamon Corner, which is 11, 12 and 13. And he's bogeyed, incidentally, he bogeyed the 10th, which is the start, really, the precursor to Eamon Corner, a very tough par 4, downhill, right to left, crescent-shaped hole with trees right and left and a green raised up off the fairway. And he bogeyed that, and he's also bogeyed the 12th, Golden Bell, the little par 3, such a treacherous par 3. So Sung Jae Im, having been in the lead half an hour ago at 5 under par, now back to 3 under par, tied for second place. And Cameron Smith, who is yet to start, is on 4 under par after his round of 68 yesterday. And that was an extraordinary round of 68 yesterday. He started with a double bogey, so it was 2 over par after 1, then made 8 birdies, came to the 18th 6 under, and then finished with a double bogey. So he started with a double and he finished with a double. But Cameron Smith is the man out front on 4 under par. But he is going to face the highest of this wind conditions by the looks of things, because a 30 mile an hour gust or thereabouts are expected, 30 mile an hour gusts are expected by the time he goes off in around half an hour's time. So as Cameron Smith, the leader, on 4 under par. Charles Schwartzel, the champion in 2011, famously the champion on the day that Rory McIlroy had that meltdown on the final day. Schwartzel finished with 4 consecutive birdies to win in 2011. And Charles Schwartzel, with no real form to speak of, is in second place now on 3 under par after 16 holes. A birdie on 16 just a moment ago has taken him to 3 under. And he's alongside Corey Connors, the Canadian, who's got a very good record around here, top 10 last year, and he's on 3 under par after 14. Sung Jae Im, 3 under par. Danny Willett, Njoki Neiman, both yet to start, both on 3 under par, as is the world number one, Scotty Scheffler. And Dustin Johnson, who was 3 under par, has just dropped a shot on the 9th to go back to 2 under par. But plenty of names are certainly in contention. Patrick Cantlay, incidentally, level par for the day after 9. He's on 2 under par. So where are the Irish? Well, they're, none of them are under par figures. But, you know, there's still plenty of time. And Rory McIlroy, 1 over par after 7. He's the best of the Irish. Patrick Harrington, 3 over after a bogey a few minutes ago on the 6th hole. Shane Lowry has yet to start. He's on 1 over par. He'll face the worst of the wind, though. And I really do mean it is wind. It's more than a breeze now. And around these 100-foot-high Georgia pines, it is so tricky to judge the wind with so many shots requiring such precision. So Shane Lowry will have the toughest of the conditions, as will Tiger Woods. He's out at 20-7 and on 1 under par after that extraordinary comeback round of 71 yesterday. And just mention of Seamus Power, 5 over after 13, probably needs a birdie or two. Maybe 3 over par might make the cut. We don't know how much this wind is going to affect the afternoon scorers, but Seamus Power on 5 over after 13 certainly seems to need something. So Cameron Smith, without hitting a ball, finds himself in the lead here in this second round, and he's one stroke clear on 4 under par from Charles Schwartzel, Corey Connors, Sungjae Im, Danny Willett, Joaquin Neiman, and Scotty Scheffler.
So that's the state of play. Just focusing on the Irish contingent, Greg, you mentioned Seamus Power 5 over, Rory McIlroy 1 over at the moment through 7. Shane Lowry should be teeing off there in the next couple of moments. Do you put Seamus Power's round in particular down to the conditions, or is it just a bad day at the office?
He's had the best of the conditions. He was off early, just after 9 o'clock local time, 2 o'clock Irish time. So he was off in one of the very first matches, so he had the calmest of the conditions. Seamus, you know, he just didn't make a birdie for 27 holes and made a birdie on the 10th, gave it straight back on the 11th, and unfortunately he's dropped another shot. He's actually had 2 drop shots in the back 9 and 2 birdies in the back 9. So if he got in on 73 today, and that requires a couple of birdies, I think that will make the cut the way things are going. But, no, he hasn't been playing terribly well, not the form that we've seen him play and show for much of this season. He's a bit unfortunate. He's been drawn with Lucas Herbert, the Irish Open champion, who has been extraordinarily slow. I followed them for a good hour and a half, and really the slowness of their three ball, they're about a hole behind the match in front. It certainly hasn't helped Seamus. It's not the reason why he's at 5 over par, but it doesn't help when you have a player like that who is extremely slow, and there was a ruling that Herbert looked for which took all 15 minutes, almost 15 minutes on the third, and that's meant that they're under the gun and probably on the clock at some point in this round. That's not an excuse, though. He's 5 over par, needs birdies. As I think does Patrick Harrington, or certainly needs to stay at no worse than 3 over par. And with the wind up, that's going to be tough. He's now facing tough holes. The 7th, the 10th, the 11th are particularly difficult holes coming ahead for him. He's playing the 7th right now. As I said, Shane Lowry and Tiger Woods will be out in the highest of that wind.
Is there any fear that play might be suspended, or is it a case of over the weekend? Is it due to get any worse in terms of setting the scene for us, Greg?
Oh no, and there's no threats of suspension. Certainly, you need thunder activity for there to be a suspension of play, because actually that's dangerous, and yeah, crowds have to be looked after in terms of the potential for a lightning strike. And so thereby, that's the only real scenario where you will get a suspension of play, other than a very, very heavy rain. And there is no rain of any nature, real kind of threatening of suspension of play nature here for the next couple of days. So I think we're okay in terms of getting this tournament played out on Sunday.
Okay, well, that is certainly positive. Greg Allen, will be checking in with you a little bit later on as we discuss there. Shane Lowry due to be out on course, so we'll get an update on himself, and hopefully Seamus Power can find a birdie. So we will wait and see. Alan Colley is live in studio with me, and we will be chatting Association Football a little bit later on. But Alan, I know you've been following the golf, and just going off what Greg has said there, who are you following in particular?
Evening, Shane. Of course, yeah, it's probably my most famous sporting month, April. I absolutely love the Masters. Obviously, we all have the football all year round, but in terms of specific competitions, I love the Masters, and you also have the snooker coming up the end of April as well. You have the Grand National, so I think April's a brilliant month. But yeah, I have been following the golf. I'll be glued to it all weekend. I've had a little dabble as well in terms of who I fancy, as most people would, and Dustin Johnson and Patrick Cantlay are my two fancies for this weekend, and they're going okay as well. They've had a good start. It's interesting there when you watch it, Shane, though. like Greg mentioned Charles Schwartzel, and obviously he's been a great player over the years, but it's amazing the likes of him, the two players who stick out for me on the leaderboard are past winners who have no form over the last maybe 18 months to 2 years, 3 years even, like you look, and the two are Danny Willett and Charles Schwartzel. Yet it's something about, you go back to obviously Augusta and they have fond memories of it, and probably their finest moment in golf is when they won the Masters themselves, and there they are kind of reignited by the place itself and doing very well, obviously getting off to a great start. Danny Willett sitting on 3 under and Charles Schwartzel having a good day today again. So it's just interesting that, you know, that players who you could be totally out of form, the whole kind of form line all throughout the season, throughout the year, no one predicting that they might do anything in the tournament, and then all of a sudden these past winners or previous winners who have such fond memories all of a sudden get reignited. So the Masters is just an incredible event. I'll be glued to it all weekend, Shane. After me football fix tonight in Talca Park, and from then on it's Masters golf all the way.
Absolutely, already getting a bit giddy for that Dublin Derby this evening. Alan will be sticking around for the hour. We'll be chatting football a little bit later. We'll be chatting horse race very shortly as a wry smile comes across Alan Colley's face as we'll be chatting to Ruby and Jane Mangan. A couple of news headlines actually to get through that caught my eye today. Munster will take on Exeter in the Heineken Champions Cup tomorrow without captain Peter O'Mahony and out half Joey Carberry, who are both ruled out with injury. Ireland flanker O'Mahony has a hamstring injury while Carberry has a knee injury. Jack O'Donoghue captains the side in the Champions Cup for the first time with 8 changes in total to the side that lost to Leinster last week. For Ulster, well, Ben Moxham will make his first European start for the Northern Province in the first leg of the round of 16 clash against Toulouse tomorrow afternoon. Moxham is named on the left wing alongside Mike Lowry at fullback and Robert Balakoon on the right wing. Stuart McCluskey comes in to start and will partner James Hume in the centre. Billy Burns and John Cooney return to form from the halfback pairing. Sticking with rugby, former Leinster and Ireland back row Sean O'Brien has announced his intention to retire at the end of the season. Very best of luck to Sean. Former world champion ship finalist Nigel Bond has announced his retirement from professional snooker at the age of 56, and Boris Becker has been found guilty at a London court of 4 charges relating to his 2017 bankruptcy. The 6-time Grand Slam tennis champion, who's 54 years of age, was accused of hiding millions of pounds worth of assets, including 2 Wimbledon trophies, to avoid paying his debts. So for those stories and more, download the RT News app or have a gander at the RT Sport website for full details. Now, before we take a quick 90 second break, just time to plug our competition again in case you missed it at the top of the show. So we have teamed up with Aldi, official fresh food partner to Irish rugby, to give away a pair of tickets to the TikTok Women's Six Nations match between Ireland and Italy in Musgrave Park this Sunday. A match we'll be previewing a little bit later on this evening with Alison Donnelly from scrumqueens.com. One lucky person will win a pair of tickets to the game plus a €50 voucher for Aldi. So to be in with a chance of winning, text 51552 with your name and answer to the following question: who is the head coach of the Irish women's rugby team? And stay tuned as the winner will be selected and contacted before 7 p.m. at the end of our show this evening. As always, RTE competition terms and conditions apply. See 2fm.ie for details. So they are the news headlines. Horse racing is up next.
RTE 2fm. On 2FM with Green Farm. Get real with Green Farm's chicken and turkey range. Real protein, real tasty.
Game on.
Racing.
Now, you're very welcome back to Game On this Friday evening as we turn our attention to horse racing and we turn our attention to the Aintree Grand National Festival in the company of Jane Mangan, Ruby Walsh and Alan Colley live in studio. Jane Mangan, if I come to you first, because we've been chatting to Ruby all week already, what have you made of day two of the Aintree Festival? 4 grade ones, John Bond winning out in the 220, Ahoy Senor Fakir Dudars in half 3, and then 20-5 Jelena Bello. So what has been your highlight of the day, Jane?
To be honest, it has been the novice chase. It was only 4 runners against Ahoy Senor in Ahoy Senor's race, but there was a lot of reputations on the line. Lomprese was brilliant all season. Could he back it up? You had the reputation of Brave Man's Game. You had Fury Road, he's a grade one winner from Ireland in there. But Ahoy Senor just went from the front and he burned off his rivals. Yes, Paul Nichols got a piece of the cake with Janine Lovello, and obviously that's very important for him in the Trainers' Championship, having secured the bowl yesterday with Clanda Zabo. But you've been chatting to Ruby. I've been listening to him all day. What did he make of it?
Ruby Walsh.
What did I make of it? I thought it was a victory for Derek Fox. Psycho Man
I think the effort and work he has put into High Senor all year. High Senor is a very, very good horse, but his jumping has been sort of questionable all year. And I think Derek Fox has done a huge amount of work with Peter Scudamore and Lucinda Russell to make this horse what he is. He's a horse with a huge amount of talent, but his brain and his feet don't always work at the same speed. And I think Derek Fox has done a wonderful job on him. He's a native of Sligo. He now works in the north of England for Lucinda Russell in Scotland even. And I thought it was a victory for him, a real good horseman who's getting the reward that hard work deserves.
And I think it would be remiss of me not to mention Ruby, El Fabiolo, who I gave a little shout out for. He came second. I was hoping for an each way shout.
Yeah, it was a good shout, Shane. You mentioned yesterday, and he was very unlucky. I mean, a faller after an unseat at the third last hurdle definitely gave the advantage to John Bond, who got three or four lengths, and then El Fabiolo then rallied and got upside, goes to the last hurdle, but a mistake there gave the advantage back to John Bond. So it was a really good run from Willie's horse, but John Bond ultimately saw it out, and at least there was good Irish success with Bacher Dudari in the Melling Chase, who won back-to-back Melling Chase, the first horse to do it since Whitepool, who steadies, and a good bit of placing from Joseph O'Brien and a nice winner for Mark Walsh.
Absolutely, a bit more positivity on an Irish front, which is great to see. Listen, folks, before we look at the Grand National tomorrow, there is the small matter of three other Grade Ones. Jane, if I come back to yourself, 2:25 tomorrow in the Novices Hurdle, is it too blinkered of me to suggest that this is a two-horse race between Three Stripe Life and Walking on Air?
I'm not so sure. Walking on Air, he was impressive when he's one star today, but he's obviously extremely fragile because he has seen a lot of him. I think he was penciled in to go to the Ballymore. He actually missed Cheltenham, and I've always been a fan of Three Stripe Life. He's always come up against one of Willie's better horses, but I don't think there's one in this tomorrow. I think this is his opportunity to break Grade One status, and while Davy Russell had a Grade One taken from him yesterday in the stewards' room, it might be just a good opportunity for him and Gordon Elliott to gain some compensation.
Okay, Ruby, in the Novices Chase, 3 p.m, Tom Cannon on board Edward Stone is the odds-on favourite here, but it'll be a close one, especially with Gentleman Demi and Third Time Lucky in the field as well.
Yeah, it probably will be, but I think Gentleman Demi, who likes the front run, will really suit Edward Stone. I'd imagine Third Time Lucky will follow the two of them, but I thought Tom Cannon did really well at the Cheltenham Festival. The guy who'd never ridden the winner there, riding a sharp price favourite, he handled the pressure really well and gave Edward Stone a really good ride, and I think he'll back up. Horses have a really good record, Shane, coming from Cheltenham in the Arkle, coming here to entry for that 2 mile novice chase, and I think it's almost Edward Stone's to lose. I know official ratings, the judges would have Gentleman to Me and Edward Stone close together, but I think one is a cheese a hell of a lot more than the other, and I would be with Edward Stone in that one.
Okay, and Ruby, sticking with yourself before we move on to the big one, just a 25-4, the Liverpool Hurdle. Who is your eye drawn to here?
It'll be with Flooring Porter. Look, the scenes after Flooring Porter won the Stairs Hurdle at the Cheltenham Festival, the syndicate that were there, everyone that was involved, they had a really good day. But look, Cheltenham is a big town, but it's not big enough to cater for everybody that goes racing, and people get dispersed all around Gloucester and that part of England, whereas in Liverpool, everybody stays in the city, and I think the whole Flooring Porter gang, they'll have some fun tomorrow, and if he wins, they will paint Liverpool red, even if they're not Liverpool fans. They'll have some fun here tomorrow, and I hope he wins for Danny Mullins and Gavin Cromwell.
Okay, it will be interesting to see how that one goes. So, I suppose getting to the big one, the 174th running of the Grand National at Aintree, a typically wide-open renewal of the world's most famous steeplechase, and it could once again pay to stick with the Irish, who of course have landed four of the last five runnings. The Charlie Longson-trained Snow Leopardess, however, heads to betting. But what tickles your fancy, Jane Mangan?
Well, 500,000 to the winner. 21 of the 40 are Irish trained. 7 runners for Gordon Elliott, 5 for JP McManus in Jenkinstown. I think there's every chance we're going to bring this home, Shane. Now, we had 9 of the first 10 home in last year's race. Are we going to have the same dominance? It's very, very possible. We have strength and depth in here. We have to start with last year's winner. Manila Times is up £15, running off top weight this year. Rachel Blackmore remaining loyal, but it's going to be very, very difficult. School by Hours has got into the race. The reserve that gets in, Sean Flanagan now switching from Cocoa Beach onto Noel Mead's horse, winner of the Paddy Power. Any second now, last year's third for 10, Mark Walsh, a brilliant chance. Davy Russell would have had the choice of a number of Gordon Elliott contingents. He's gone for Run Wild Fred, but he would not have had the choice of Delta Work, because that's Jack Kennedy's ride. He was awesome at Cheltenham, whether we liked it or not. Yes, he did play somewhat of a Grinch role when he denied Tiger Roll of a fairy tale ending to his career. But I think that's where my shillings are going to go. Albeit he's not a big each-way price. If I was going each-way, I think Mount Ida has a nice chance for Dennis O'Regan at 33-1 or bigger. But if you are supporting the mares, if you're on Snow Leopard S or Mount Ida or Augusta Gold, bear in mind, a mare has not won the Aintree Grand National since 1951. And I just know that Ruby Walsh is going to tell me, which mare won it in 1951?
I've no idea, Jen. You may tell me. I wasn't remembering 51. Maybe you were.
Nickel coin. Somebody caught me with this earlier in the week, and I just felt like I had to pass on the baton.
No, thanks very much. Very kind of you. I actually think Snow Leopard S. I think she could have done with some more rain, Shane. It's been a really bright, dry day in Liverpool today. Not that warm, but I don't think the ground will be snow enough for Snow Leopard S or for Augusta Gold. So I think the wait for a mare to win the Aintree Grand National will continue. I'm not so sure Manila Times comes here in the same sort of form he was in last year. He fell in the John Durkin chase and punched down in his first start and was bitterly disappointed in the Leopardstown chase. So I think it's going to be hard for him. I probably do agree with Jane, though. I do think there'll be an Irish winner, and I think it'll come from either Delta Work, Ascari at 10, Any Second Now, or Longhouse Poet. I think they're the big four Irish runners. I'll be shouting for Any Second Now for my dad. I hope he wins. He's the one I'd like to be on anyway, Shane, and that's probably my heart rule in my head.
Okay, well, there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. So they're the expert opinions of Jane Mangan and Ruby Walsh, and I suppose the not-so-expert opinion of Alan Colley, not to put you down.
No, just a fan, Shane. But I was listening to Ruby's analysis today, and one that caught my eye after what he said about him was they did a lovely montage on Trevor Hemmings during the racing coverage today, and then Ruby spoke about Clothcap, so I think he will be in with a shout. Run Wild Fred, there's money for him as well, and obviously Davey was denied yesterday, so I would fancy maybe him running a big race. But the question, Ruby, I would ask, and Jane, just looking at obviously the Aintree Festival and coming so close after Cheltenham, you look at the placings from Joseph with Facu Duderies. Is that good placings, Ruby, or should Facu Duderies gone to Cheltenham to take on Alaho? Or do you think, as I say, that was a good placing to think maybe I'm not as good as Alaho, but I'll go to Aintree a fresh horse and take the money there?
Well, he didn't have to think he's not as good as Alaho because they've ran against each other three times and he's lost every time, so he's just not as good as Alaho. I would say that is good placing, and you should try and win where you can with your horses. But you also have to remember then, Alan, to back up your point maybe, winning at Cheltenham can be life-changing. There's only one race at Liverpool that will change your life, and that's the Grand National. The rest are important races, but they don't carry the significance of any race at the Cheltenham Festival. So there's a pro and a con there, but there's big prize money on offer here, and they're good races, and Joseph O'Brien has targeted a race and claimed a big pot with Facu Duderian. That's good judgments. But as regards what the importance of Cheltenham is towards Aintree, there's only the Grand National that's life changing in Aintree, and somebody's life will change tomorrow afternoon.
Not to be putting you on the spot, Jane, but I suppose Alan posed the question to Ruby, so I'll pose one to yourself. Now, I'm not sure if you've been tuning in the last couple of nights, but Ruby's been fair impressed with some of my knowledge of horse racing that I've definitely not just been plagiarising from certain podcasts and certain columns and that. But I'm going with the 80-1 each way shout for Phoenix Way, purely because the Phoenix rising from the ashes, just like my beloved Shelburne. So Phoenix Way ran well in two big handicap chases at Ascot during the winter, winning on the latter occasion, and was well fancy to follow up in Kempton's Coral Trophy last time. Unfortunately, he suffered a heavy fall at the third fence, but he is not out of it. That has not dented his confidence. So, am I onto a winner with Phoenix Way? Not to be putting you on the spot, Jane.
Well, I have been listening in to your analysis during the week, and I am impressed with the research that you've done, and you may well be right, because when you come into the Grand National, you have a chance. I don't know an awful lot about Phoenix Way. Do I fancy him? I don't, but I'm not going to put you off at 80-1 because he's 80-1 for a reason. But there is some fantastic stories through the race. I know Snow Leopardess is probably favourite because she's had a fall. She missed 2 years because of a leg injury, and now she's back. But wouldn't it be wonderful if the 150-1 winner of last year's Irish Grand National managed to win this year's Aintree Grand National for Dermot McLaughlin, Freewheeling Dylan?
Ricky Doyle aboard. And the horse that was third in Fairy House last year, Enjoy Dallin from Kira Murphy and Conor Orr. There's a lot of Irish yards represented here. It's not just, I suppose, in Cheltenham when Willie Mullins had 10 winners, people were thinking, oh my God, it's a little bit of a dominance effect. That's not the case in the Grand National tomorrow. There's a cross-section of stories that would be brilliant. And I just hope when everybody goes to post at 5:15 that we get a clean race, a safe race, and we have a wonderful winner.
Yeah, absolutely. Hopefully everybody comes home safe and sound. Ruby,
Shane,
I leave the...
Shane, you were doing so well. You were nailing it.
Phoenix Ways and
Thursday. You nailed it Wednesday, you nailed it Thursday, but unfortunately for you, Phoenix Way was taken out this morning. So
oh, no.
He can't win the Grand National.
Oh, no.
Not even at 82-1.
I'm heartbroken.
The last hurdle, Shane, with the research.
Come on, Shane.
I'm putting this down to Ruby, just purely because I know you're such a big fan. And Jane, you still promised to get to a game. It's Dublin Derby Day. My head has been distracted with Shelver and Shamrock.
Self praise is no praise, yeah, Shane.
I was third on day one, second on day two, and I thought I was going to go. Ruby, you're after crushing me there. Well,
but
on
now,
that note.
The main question is, Shane, you haven't got your shillings on a non-runner. So where are your 4 or 5 shillings on?
Oh, I tell you what then, the Rasher counter, because I'm going for a few drinks with a butcher later. So the Rasher counter, 40-1.
As good a reason as any.
Brilliant.
Well, on that note, so the Grand National is tomorrow evening, I should say. I've lost the run myself. Jane Mangan, thank you very much. Ruby Walsh, thank you very much. Alan Colley, thank you very much. You'll be sticking around because we'll be chatting your expert opinion on soccer in a few moments' time. So do stay with us here on Game On.
RTE 2FM.
On 2FM with Green Farm. Being up to 90 isn't real. The protein in our range is. Get real with Green Farm. Real protein, real tasty.
Game On.
Football.
Now, hello once again. You are very welcome back to Game On this Friday evening. After my own goal in the horse racing predictions, I'm hoping for a cleaner start and perhaps a clean sheet in our soccer chat with Alan Colley and Fergal Brennan, who joins us on the line as well. Gentlemen, before we chat domestic action, I suppose we turn our attention to the English Premier League. And I usually like going chronological order, but I suppose there is only one place to start. And Fergal, if I come to yourself, Manchester City versus Liverpool. A big one.
It is indeed. This game seems like it's been building up since before Christmas. Even when Liverpool were in a position where they were trailing, Liverpool fans will remember they were trailing City by 14 points at one stage, albeit with a couple of games in hand. But this has been building and building and building for weeks. Liverpool have got the sense that they can catch Manchester City or at least get close to them. They go into this just a point behind them, and it is huge. It is huge. The build-up is justified because it will define the season. If Manchester City win, they go 4 points clear, and you would expect that will be enough for them to hold on. If Liverpool can go and get a win at the Etihad, which I think is only the second time under Jurgen Klopp in the league at the Etihad, if he manages to do it, it would flip the title race completely around, because then Liverpool would have the advantage in the remaining game. So it is all or nothing, and the hype around it. I was at Jurgen Klopp's press conference this morning, is absolutely massive, and both managers, as you would expect, are doing everything they can to make sure the players are motivated and ready, but just trying to reduce the pressure a little bit, because this is huge.
I'm usually not one to buy into the greatest league in the world and all the drama. Football only began in 91, but Alan Colley, this is huge, as Fergal says.
It's as good as it gets, Shane, yeah. And to be fair, since the Premier League era, or even if you go back before that, it's as two as good a teams as we'll ever see, to be fair. And I think what separates them in this tie as well, obviously they have the best sets of players between them, but I think they have the best managers, not only in the Premier League, I think the two best managers in the world. I think Klopp and Guardiola are just so far ahead of everyone else in terms of the job that they've done at both those clubs. I think it's been absolutely phenomenal. People will point to money, but you still have to manage that setup and the players in terms of the quality of player as well and the profile of player that you're dealing with. And I think those two are just a million miles ahead of everyone else. So they garner their own hype and their own kind of, as Fergal said, the press conference this morning with Klopp, without even the football side of things, just those two profiles alone garner such hype, Klopp and Guardiola, because when they speak, people listen and take notice of what they have to say. So I think this is an absolute monster clash. When you put it in terms of the football and the context of the league as well, as Fergal said, we were writing I don't know if I ever wrote Liverpool off, but people were suggesting and thinking, with good reason, I suppose, with a 14-point lead, that the league was all over. But I think you'd be crazy to write off Liverpool when they have a manager as good as him and a group of players that they have as well, because of not only the quality that they have, I think the characters that Liverpool have, in my opinion, that's what separates them from Man City. I think Man City might have better individual players, but I think Liverpool have a better character of player in terms of, you look at the likes of a Henderson or a Milner, or the professionalism of those boys, Fabinho, those kind of players, Robertson, that you know what you're getting out of them every week. I think, as I say, Man City probably have more star quality in terms of individuals and game changers, if you want. Liverpool have those at the top end of the pitch, but there's quality dotted all over the pitch with both sets of players, and I can't wait for Fergal. I think these two clubs have been setting the bar quite high now. I think the rivalry that they've built up over the last few years has been phenomenal. I think it's only going to get stronger as well, and they're obviously facing off in all the best competitions. We may have them in the Champions League as well, with the FA Cup semi-final to come, and I think this Sunday is going to be absolutely mega.
So do you think the extra bite that I suppose you're describing there about Liverpool will be enough to see them victorious come Sunday evening?
Yeah, because I think when you look at Liverpool over the last number of weeks, and I think they haven't been beaten in the league since the Christmas period against Leicester, and they've obviously won all the games. I think it's 10 on the bounce now. It's phenomenal, really, and particularly during the month of January when they were missing Mane and Salah as well for the African Nations. But the thing that's got them through those games, because I don't think they've been playing as well as what we kind of normally would associate with Liverpool when they're on song, but they're getting the job done, and that's probably due to the resilience that they have and the characters in that squad, that even when they're not playing well, which is always a sign of a great team, Shane, even when they're not playing well, they get the job done. And you look at the games and the performances over the last number of weeks, as I say, they haven't been riding high in terms of the levels that they can reach, but they're still getting the job done, so it wouldn't surprise me at all. And the other reason is because I think Guardiola fears Liverpool massively, particularly that forward line. I often go back to that documentary where he was referencing them left, right and centre throughout it. It's the only ones that I feel get up his back and that worried him, is Liverpool, and particularly those front players. So it wouldn't surprise me at all if Liverpool go there and get a win.
Okay, well, Fergal Brennan mentioned a little bit earlier, he was at the Jurgen Klopp press conference, and Klopp was trying to subdue, I suppose, expectation and the hype around it. But let's hear what both managers had to say on each other.
Pep is the best coach in the world. I think we all would agree on that. And it might be a coincidence that it didn't work out so far in the Champions League or whatever, but the things he won, the football he plays, yeah, so if anybody doubts him, then I have no idea how that could happen.
Is it that old thing, or that sort of classic thing, whereby you wouldn't have been as good a football team if Liverpool weren't pushing you?
Absolutely. You know, when you achieve 100 points and after 98 points, you need someone that push you from behind to realize, oh my God, we are there, we are close. You know, you make the mirror and, oh, it's here, they are here. Then you have to make another step, that's for sure. And I think, I don't know Liverpool, what's going to do, but knowing the club and our chairman and CEOs and the rest, we want to grow. And I'm pretty sure we want to be there more years. And I'm pretty sure Liverpool and the other teams are going to try to do it.
Okay, so there are the thoughts of Jurgen Klopp and Pep Guardiola. Fergal, one story that I was reading today, and I asked this question, I suppose, with the backdrop of Chelsea's results and, I suppose, a narrative emerging that perhaps they're being distracted by off-field issues. And there's an investigation into potential rule-breaking at Manchester City focused on illegal payments for underage players, inflated sponsorship deals and hidden salary payments made to a former manager. German newspaper Der Spiegel claims the Premier League has been investigating the club for 3 years, the publication says. According to Der Spiegel, the Premier League champions allegedly pressured underage players to sign contracts with Manchester City through monetary payments in violation of the rules. Club sponsors in Abu Dhabi are alleged to have provided only a portion of their payments to the club themselves, with the remainder reportedly made up by club owner Sheikh Mansour, a member of the Abu Dhabi ruling family. And I suppose my question here is, when stories like these are breaking on, well, not the eve, it is Sunday evening that the Liverpool City match is, players are surely picking up the newspaper, or they're picking up their phone and scrolling through Twitter and so on. How distracting are those stories to players, do you feel? Or is it a case of, I'm playing for a club, one of the richest in the world, it's just par of the course?
I would say it's probably more the latter. And it's not to be flippant about the Der Spiegel story or the investigation into City. And it's not the first time Manchester City have been investigated for financial impropriety or breaking FFP rulings. And it sounds a little bit a little bit bread and butter, but it is the truth that Manchester City, certainly the first team, the first 11 that will be playing on Sunday against Liverpool, this doesn't really apply to them. Manchester City is such an enormous organisation, whether or not there is wrongdoing or financial mismanagement or even something potentially a bit more sinister going on behind the scenes, it doesn't impact them. It would probably be the short answer. That's not, as I say, to dismiss this investigation and what Der Spiegel have done, and Der Spiegel do a lot of really good work in looking into these types of things involving football clubs. But in terms of the build-up for this weekend, Guardiola was asked about it in his press conference, and he essentially said, I'm aware of it, but it's not in my thinking ahead of this weekend, and it won't be something that he will even deal with either. There's so many different sections within the chain of command within a club like Manchester City or Liverpool or Manchester United that it doesn't really come home to roost unless it is a situation like Chelsea with the sanctions that they're under at the moment, which is restricting probably 80-90% of Thomas Tuchel's job. So, yeah, it will be on the minds of Manchester City at the weekend, but it will not be Pep Guardiola that's dealing with it, and it certainly won't be his players.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that is only one of a host of Premier League matches across the weekend. Alan, Newcastle Wolves this evening. Newcastle trying to avoid the relegation zone. Everton, Man United, Saturday afternoon at 12:30. Chelsea will need a response against Southampton as well. I suppose Everton, Man U, 12:30. Is that the other standout, I suppose? United looking for a bit of positivity and Everton needing a bit of positivity considering what happened to them against Burnley.
Yeah, it's a massive game. I think it's a massive story what's happening with Everton, and Fergus obviously is a lot closer to it than us, but certainly what's gone on all year and all season and the major problems and issues not only on the pitch but definitely off the pitch also. But when I say it's a massive story that's developing, for Everton to be relegated, and when you think of the money that's been spent at that club over the last recent seasons, Shane, I think they're in absolute, like, they're so close to it now. That defeat during the week to Burnley, because everybody was saying weeks ago that they have so many more home games compared to the other teams around them, and they had games in hand. But you look at the table now, and they are in dire straits. They really are. Lampard is struggling badly. The group of players as well, psychologically, I think the damage that might have been done to losing to Burnley during the week as well might have huge implications. The only thing is, they won't need to get motivated for the game tomorrow. I'm sure the crowd will be right behind them in terms of Man United coming today to Goodison Park as well. But they're desperate for a result, and I feel as though they have to get one because they are really staring down the barrel.
Fergal, how bad are things at Everton, I suppose, is the simplistic question.
Bad, very bad. It's difficult to kind of explain to people the contrast in the city between Liverpool fans and Everton fans. You've got Liverpool fans that are absolutely brimming with excitement and anticipation in what could be a record-breaking season. They've already picked up one trophy. They're probably going to get at least one more. And you've got Everton, as you say, staring down the barrel. They've never been relegated from the Premier League. I think it was the mid-50s, possibly, the last time that they were relegated even from the top tier. This is massive. And they do, probably a Christmas, January time, they're in that block of too good to go down, which is a dangerous, dangerous thing to throw at any team or any set of players. But the Burnley game in midweek was almost symptomatic of what's going on, because Sean Dyche has been so calm and together through all of this. He just kept referring back to the fact they have games in hand, he's confident in his players, they've been there and done that. And that's what happened. His post-match after the Burnley game, he was essentially mocking Frank Lampard, where he revealed his half-time team talk to the Burnley players. And that is the situation. Frank Lampard looks afraid, whereas Sean Dyche, strangely, actually looks quite confident, because he's been there, done that, and bought the T-shirt. And it is bad for Everton that they're not too good to go down by any stretch. As Alan said, the amount of money they've spent on players doesn't matter between now and the end of the season. It really, really doesn't matter. What matters is the 9 games between now and the end of the season. And they're in big trouble, but there is still a big chunk of football to go. And I would keep looking at Leeds, because they have to wait on everybody. They've played 31 and they've only got 30 points. So they're still in it. And the old 40-point magic mark is gone now. It's probably 36, 37 where you'd be safe. And you start looking Newcastle up, they're probably okay. I still think Leeds are in there if somehow, by hook or by crook, Everton can get a result. Burnley are away at Norwich this weekend, who are dead and buried for me. And if they win that, or even if they get a draw, they could drag themselves out of this. So I think Leeds are still in it, but things are bad for Everton, because the home games are important and the Goodison Park crowd is a fantastic stadium to go to, but things are turning toxic and Lampard just doesn't seem to have a clue on how to turn it around.
Fergal, that's the interesting point for me, because obviously the story will be Everton Football Club, as you outlined, never been relegated. They're such a huge club, huge history, huge heritage, always been part of the top flight. And if they were to go down, I feel it would be absolutely massive. But also at play, I feel there's the ego of Frank Lampard, and obviously we saw him at Chelsea where he failed effectively, when you see what Tuchel has come in and done. Now he's after taking over Everton. So I think not only is the story about Everton going down, but the damage in terms of Frank Lampard, obviously one of England's best players, huge, brilliant career that he had himself, but his stock as a manager would be basically forever gone, I feel, if he was to take Everton down as well. So how much blame has been laid at his door since he's come in? Or is it, like, I've heard some Everton fans on different platforms basically pointing out that obviously they got rid of Benitez, and now a lot of blame must lie at the door of the players as well. But just in the city alone, how much blame has been laid at Lampard's door?
I'd say it's probably still 60-40, 70-30 against Benitez. I wouldn't quite say it's being framed as Lampard came in to do an impossible job, but there was so much negativity around Rafa Benitez. And it is such a mad situation where you've got a really unpopular managerial choice at the start of the season that was consistently never more than moderate levels of acceptance as Everton manager. And then Lampard comes in, and it's almost as bad. It's not as bad, but almost as bad. And that's been the big problem. You've got a manager that so many fans never wanted, were absolutely itching for him to get sacked. He got sacked. They brought a manager in that people were initially kind of positive about, and it's turned so, so quickly. And that's what's impacted this negative downward spiral for them. And to answer your question in a bit of a roundabout way, I would say it's still majority on Rafa. But if Frank Lampard is actually the manager standing there on the last game of the season when Everton go down, you can't just delete that picture.
Okay, well, a huge weekend in the Premier League. Fergal Brennan, thank you very much. Alan Colley, we'll move our attention to the League of Ireland. And there are three fixtures this evening: Drogheda v Bowes, St Pat's v Dundalk, and Shelburne v Shamrock Rovers in the historic Tolka Park. So, where would you like to begin, Alan Colley?
Well, I'm going to Tolka Park, Shane. I'm looking forward to the game. As you say, you've built it up already. You've mentioned it, I think, only the five times throughout the show so far.
There's a drinking game being had.
I can't believe you even asking me the question, where are we going first? There was only one place.
I needed to be some way impartial.
Yeah, exactly. No, I'm heading along to Tolka Park. I'm looking forward to it. They obviously had a brilliant result last week, beating Sligo Rovers away from home. They'll be looking to follow up, because it has been a bit hit and miss so far this season for them, Shane, and we spoke about it a few times on the show. But I fully, and I've said this on numerous occasions anytime we've mentioned Shelburne, and it is very much early in the season, I think they will get better as the season goes on, because when you think of the turnover of players that obviously won the first division that had left, and Damien Duff came in, and obviously it's effectively a new squad. So it was always going to take time to gel and build those relationships with players, and I think, as I say, the longer the season goes on, the better they will get. But for me, this season for Shelburne was all about just establishing themselves back in the Premier Division, finish sixth, finish seventh, and build from there. There's no kind of as I say, unrealistic targets being set, I don't think, from the outside, maybe amongst the manager and the players themselves. But I think that would be success for Shelburne this year. And if they're, as I say, to establish themselves back in the Premier Division and build on that, that's all they need to do this year.
Yeah, it's just nice to have Dublin Derby to look forward to. Unfortunately, we are pushed for time. The other two matches, Keith Long under pressure. He's not under pressure. He is under pressure. Will Bowes get a result up in Drogheda? And will Stevie O'Donnell return to St Pat's and Inchicore with a victory?
I think the Keith Long thing is crazy, really, because it changes week to week. I was in Dalymount last week. At half time, the fans, I never seen them as happy. At full time, they want the Keith Long out the door. Tuesday night, they beat Sligo away from home and they're all love him again. So that changes from game to game, which I think is indicative of what we see in modern day football now, Shane. So I don't think he's under pressure. I think he's done a good job over the years.
Will they win this evening?
Yeah.
They will.
I hope Kevin Doherty is not listening to that. He's my best friend and he manages Drogheda.
And a Shelburne man as well.
I think Bowes will win, and I think Pats will beat Dundalk as well in the other game.
Okay, so it won't be a happy return for Stephen O'Donnell. Alan Colley, thank you very much. We'll be turning our attention to rugby next, and we'll be going full circle and back to Greg Allen to get the latest from Augusta. So do stay tuned.
RTE 2FM.
On 2FM with Green Farm. Being flat to the mat isn't real. Our protein is. Get real with Green Farm. Real protein, real tasty.
Game on.
Rugby.
Now you're very welcome back to Friday evening's Game On as we turn our attention to the Women's Six Nations in the company of Ali Donnelly, the editor of scrumqueens.com. Alison, big weekend in the rugby tomorrow, England-Wales at 4:45, Sunday Scotland-France at 1 p.m. But the interest here is Ireland v Italy at 5 p.m. down in Cork. So, I suppose team news was announced today. Beifin Parsons is back in the Ireland team as one of six changes. She gets a nod ahead on the left wing, with Lucy Mulhall switching to fullback and Emer Considine dropping out of the matchday squad. Catherine Dane comes in for Evian Riley at scrum half. Hannah O'Connor replaces Brittany Hogan at number eight. And Christy Haney gets her first test start at tight head prop in place of Katie O'Dwyer. Aoife Doyle comes onto the bench, which also includes uncapped 19-year-old back Aoife Wafer, a product of Enniscorthy Rugby Club, who now plays with Blackrock. So are you surprised? Is it expected changes? Or what do you make of the team selection, Ali?
Yeah, look, I think it's, you know, it's expected because, you know, this is a third weekend in a row the girls are turning around playing big test matches, including big week of travel in between against France. So it's hard to ask them to back that up. Some of them, you know, will have gone working in the interim as well. So I think, you know, switching things around and making some changes is a good thing. Obviously, as well, they haven't been winning. So, you know, the coaches have got to try and look at some other players now and see can they turn their fortunes around this weekend. You know, I think Catherine Dane's a very experienced, you know, very good nine. I think she'll change things up a little bit, and everybody wants to see Parsons in. So let's see what she can do. But I was looking at the Italy team, and just before we came on, just counting the caps in the backs alone, 363 in the Italian backline, 83 for Ireland. So that'll give you a sense of the experience gap that we still have at the moment, even with you know, new players coming in with a bit more experience.
Yeah, I think it's eight starters still in single figures for Irish caps in that starting 15. So as we say, it is a process, and it's all about development and the journey ahead. But you mentioned there's changes in the hopes that Ireland can turn their fortunes around. Do you feel that it is a realistic possibility now come Saturday evening? Or Sunday evening,
it is definitely. Yeah. Look, it is definitely a possibility, but absolutely. I mean, Ireland can beat Italy at home for sure. The only thing I'd say is, you know, the losses and the performance against France was poor by, you know, their own admission. And that seed of doubt sort of starts growing in the mind. Oh, can we do this with the inexperience that we have around us? You know they're going to lose players to the England-Scotland games, and that'll be, you know, there'll be a little bit of that going on there too, although I'm sure they wouldn't say that. But Italy, yeah, look, they're a good team. And I think one thing that worries me about Italy coming over is their championship really starts now. You know, they would never have expected to beat France or England, and they didn't. They had some good things going on, some good glimpses, especially in the midfield, where Beatrice Ragone is just a fantastic player, would, you know, get into most teams in the championship. She's playing 12. And so I worry a little that their mindset said is, right, let's get going, we start now, whereas Ireland, coming off the back of those two losses, and no, you don't win this weekend, things aren't looking great in the table at all then, given what I said about the England and Scotland likely selections.
Yeah, Ragone particularly showed her individual brilliance in round one against France, and will surely be involved in any tries that the Italians may score. I suppose not too much to take away from the drubbing against England, but how dangerous will Italy be, and what will the mindset be from an Italian point of view? Do you feel their morale and confidence will be hit from the opening two defeats? I know you mentioned that it is kind of just the start of their campaign now, considering the opposition that they were against, so perhaps there will be a bit of extra motivation and determination to see what they can do against, with respect, a lesser side than what they have already faced.
Yeah, I think they'll travel very confident. Look, they'll look around their team and say, there's players in here who know how to win games away from home, who know how to beat teams like Ireland, and who are extremely experienced building towards the World Cup that they'll be at later this year. I mean, Sarah Barton at nine, you know, 103 caps, one of the best nines in the game, very, very wily, very clever, spot space, particularly around the fringes. If Ireland aren't defending, you know, well for 80 minutes, you know, she will make space for them. So I think they'll come confident, and actually, you know, I don't know what the bookies are saying over there, but probably even slight favourites. I know that might sound crazy given that they've also lost two games to two big scorelines, but they've got much more experience in the team there, and you know, they'll have looked at the videotapes of Ireland. I don't know if videotapes is something that we say anymore,
very
but
retro,
they'll have looked
very
at the
retro
footage. Yeah, I've looked at the footage of the two games and thought, yeah, we can beat this team. You know, we rattle Ireland. They're going to make mistakes, and they did make an awful lot of unforced errors against France. So I think it's the pick of the weekend's games for sure, because it's the most unpredictable. But look, Ireland can beat them. You know, there are some really good things coming through that team despite all of the errors. The midfield, I think Eve Higgins, Stacey Flood, that's a really nice partnership starting to build. You know, the set piece hasn't been brilliant, but in the loose, you know, Linda, for example, in the front row, she's been great. Sam Monaghan, a few players like that. And hopefully, you know, we'll get, I don't think the weather looks great for Cork Sunday, but Parsons hopefully get some space and see what she can do.
Absolutely. Well, I'm sure there's plenty of twists and turns along the way, and hopefully it will be positive for Greg McWilliams and the Ireland team come Sunday evening. Ali Donnelly, pleasure as always. I'm sure we'll be checking in next week after this weekend's rounds of Six Nations games.
Great to
game on rugby.
Similar to last night's show, I'm going to paraphrase Big Tom, and we're going out the same way that we came in, because Greg Allen has an update from Augusta.
Yeah, and it's pretty good update from one respect. Finally, Seamus Power has made a much-needed birdie on the 16th, the par 3. It's got him to 4 over par. And it actually means that I think he may well make the cut if he stays on 4 over par, going to 17 and 18. But they are two tough holes today, especially 18th, which was the second toughest hole yesterday. But Seamus Power with a birdie goes to 4 over par, which looks like possibly being the cut. Patrick Harrington, 3 over after 9. Shane Lowry started with a bogey, but birdied the par 5 seconds, so he's gone to 1 over par after 2 holes. But Rory McIlroy has just dropped a shot on the 10th, and he's on 2 over par. Now, all of that sounds like it's a pretty average scoring, but the reason for that is the wind that's blowing, and it's blowing also for the leaders. And while the lead at the start of the day was 5 under par for Sun Jae-im, that lead is now down to 4 under par. Im has got back to 4 under with a birdie on the 13th, now playing the 15th. The Korean on 4 under par, tied for the lead with the 2016 champion Danny Willett, who's also on 4 under par. He's played 4 holes. Charles Schwartzel, the 2011 champion, has shot around a 69, and that's the clubhouse target at 3 under par, currently tied for 3rd with a number of other players, including Cameron Smith, who's 68 yesterday, has been followed by a bogey at the first. He's in that group on 3 under par. So Sung Jae-in and Danny Willett, the leaders, on 4 under par. McIlroy 2 over, Lowry 1 over, Harrington 3 over, and Seamus